listening to the Forest School podcast with Lewis Ames and Gemma Sutherland.
Hello.
Hello, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. We've not been talking at all and planning our day and doing the pretendy start.
No.
It's all legit.
Yes.
Mm.
Today,
we're
talking about, well, I'll tell you why we're talking about what we're talking about first.
Yeah, go on, give me a preamble.
So, how many weeks have we been open now since lockdown? This will be week five.
Five.
And with a lot of kids that have been before and a handful of kids that haven't come before. And one thing that I have noticed and observed since we reopened is the amount of time that pretty much all the children are spending on swings as well as in the hammocks. Mm. And so much play revolves around the big rope swing. And also just it seems to be like we were wondering, weren't we? We were speculating whether it's sort of like engaged in an activity or a game and then that finishes naturally, go and sit on a swing. And we've got the big rope swing. We've got a long log, haven't we, with strings at either end, which we often call the dragon swing. So on that one, you can kind of lie on it like a panther and wiggle around. You can go.
Yeah, it looks like a very long but low swing. And when you swing it, it's designed to absolutely take your shins out.
It's and you can go obviously backwards and forwards or side to side on it, can't you? Mm-hmm. And fit lots of people on there at once. And we've also got two smaller swings, but because the ropes are tied together at the top and then knotted around
like
the branch, it's like a triangle with a swing at the bottom of the triangle. They also kind of spin as well as swinging really easily, or swing kind of in a circular motion. And all of those things are getting loads of action, as is the obstacle course, actually. And the part of, you know, the, I don't know what the kind of name for it is, but a bit of an obstacle course where you've got just one rope on the bottom with your feet and one rope on the top of your hands. And
yeah,
we've got one
shimmy along.
And we've got one of those that isn't part of the obstacle course, but it's near the swings. And that's been up for months, hasn't it? I think we put it up for our toddler groups and it was almost like it was invisible. No one's ever used it. And then in the last 5 weeks, it's been used every day by everybody, with lots of joyful shouting and warbling. And I was going, wow, that's really interesting. Like those kind of activities have never been so popular as they are right now. And I was wondering about whether there was some sensory stuff going on, some vestibular stuff, some proprioception stuff that was particularly needed for those children, having been away from other people, having been away from any kind of childcare setting, and been at home for 4 months, whether that was a kind of self-initiated, almost like, you know, like a real need.
Well, we always say, don't we, like the children will show you what they need.
Yeah.
And, you know, given the opportunity, they were showing us that they needed it, and we were trying to dig into. So I don't know about you, I would say before last week when we kind of went, huh, that's a thing, we should look into that thing, I would say my knowledge of the vestibular system, fancy word, vestibular system, proprioception, interest, oh no, that's not true, we talked about interoception, didn't we, when we were talking about the Forest School and Autism book and that kind of internal feeling. But I would say maybe slightly deeper than this, but for the most part, I just had that thing of like, oh, children need to move, man. Children need to move their bodies. And I didn't know any more than that. I didn't understand any more than that. I just had sort of taken that at face value and hadn't really gone, well, dig a bit into that then. If you're going to hold that as a belief and an ethos, dig into it. And so there's been some very interesting articles I've read, and I found some cracking books, and oh god, I mean it is another geeky thing, isn't it? You can just get so into it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I've been doing a bit of reading about sensory stuff for my own family as well, and it's all kind of like tying together. And as you say, it's if you give yourself time to go on a little rabbit hole of research into it, then it is completely fascinating. And those light bulbs go on, as we were talking about, we were going to go, oh, if only we had known that or had that idea, you know, a year ago, that would have been really beneficial right then for that particular group. And it kind of explains a lot of behaviours. So I think you can come at it from two sides. Oh, sorry, just hit my computer. Don't hit your computer with your gesticulations that no one can even see.
Do you know what it was? Your proprioception is all over the place, mate.
Oh no, I'm quite tired. As a practitioner, you can come at it from two ways, can't you? So you can kind of go a bit like the swing situation that I've just described. Like, if I've got an awareness of this need and these benefits, then I can provide opportunities for all children to engage in activities that are going to be beneficial for their vestibular system. And that's just nice for everybody and beneficial and great, and something that they may not have access to in very many other places, depending on where they live and what they get up to in the rest of their week. But also you can come at it a bit more like a, I wouldn't say like troubleshooting, but a bit more of a kind of, yeah, light bulb moment thing. So if you've got that awareness and that grounding in what's going on, you can go, ah, that might be why this behavior is presenting itself at the moment that I can help this particular person with. So yes, kids, read up about it. Definitely recommend.
Applications for Forest School training are now open at childrenoftheforest.com. Check out the podcast links for more details.
Yeah, well, I think of it as like, I have thought for I realized a few years ago now that one of the things that interests me, and I think drew me to education, and particularly early years and primary school education, is like, I really enjoy non-verbal communication and relationship building. And to an extent, I feel slightly like one of those nature David Attenborough things where you look at it and, like, you know, the bird with funny feathers is jumping around and it's only the voiceover going like, he's displaying the size of his right toe in an experiment, which means that she will look at his...
You're basically saying that you're observing children like animals in a wildlife documentary.
Oh, I am Jane Goodall. But
definitely,
because I think it's more honest. And I do think this is one of the things that I struggle with. Struggle is the right word. Why I don't feel as drawn to secondary education is because it becomes more verbal communication. And I feel like, in a very skeptical way, verbal communication is easier to bullshit in a way that, like, if you are... No kid in early years in primary school, like, pretends to swing over and over again on the monkey bars because they think that's what they're supposed to do. Well, they might. But do you know what I mean? Like,
I do know what you mean. It's more internal. The behaviour is internal. And I also find that completely fascinating. So when I was teaching secondary, that's what I was really, like, because it is harder to get at, then when you do, it's like, oh my God, this is incredible. So, like, writing, you know, being an English teacher and going, okay, what's going on in your mind? Let's see if we can get that onto paper. And, like, play in teenagers, I just find that so fascinating because it is often internal, harder to see.
Maybe the analogy is like radio frequencies, and you can retune and go, what are you saying to me? What is your body language saying to me? What is your sensory action saying to me? And the more you sort of investigate these little areas, the more frequencies you can tune into and go, right, I can hear you on five wavelengths now, or I can, you know, now I know about I've just been reading about eye contact, right? So now I've got this extra frequency that can talk to you about this, or I've been learning about fine motor skills, and so I've got this extra thing I can tune into and see where you're at. You don't have to tell me it. Yeah. I can just see it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, completely. And I don't necessarily think that is just key for younger ages. I think there are plenty of, you know, young people who might have sensory difficulties for whatever reason.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah, yeah.
Having an awareness of that is always going to be helpful, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I was just working out if I could put into words an explanation for anybody who might not know what we're on about with the vestibular system.
Roller coasters is everything that everything about a roller coaster is basically it, isn't it? But it's all the stuff that goes on about your inner ear and your balance and, you know, moving your body through space, the feeling of muscles working and, you know, that feedback that your body is giving in different ways. And quite often that is in some ways grounding and in some ways important feedback for kind of self-regulating and being okay. Because going back to, again, it's that thing, isn't it, of like we talked about to Michael and Andy on the Forest School and Autism podcast, and lots of similar stuff that I've been reading is kind of like how much vestibular stuff children need to just maintain a sort of an even keel.
Yeah.
And so it isn't, because you might think, oh, it's a PE lesson, it's an hour a week of doing, did you do pair balances at school? I feel like I did endless. Pair balance, and then a travel, and then a finishing balance, and
yeah,
stuff like that, which is vestibular, but it's not in the same way that play is not the same as being told to write a story. Mm-hmm. It's freely chosen, I think, more of this vestibular sensory stuff.
Sorry, you know? my cat is joining in. Yeah. So yeah, kind of processing the world, the experiences that you're getting physically and through your eyes, all of that kind of shimmers. Or there's a good diagram of kind of to explain it that maybe we can like put up with the podcast somehow.
This very colourful one.
The really colourful one. It's like a picture of a kid on a swing, and then it's got an arrow to the receptors in the inner ear, and then an arrow to the brainstem, and then from the brainstem it goes to the cerebellum, which is the coordination of eye control, head movement and posture, the oculomotor nuclei, which steadies the eyes and the head as the head and body moves, and spinal cord influences muscle tone and postural adjustment, and thalamus and cortex, which interprets input, plays a role in motion perception and spatial orientation. And that diagram is from the ottoolbox.com. So this is kind of like, I think this is why we don't necessarily know that much about it coming from an education background, because this is moving into the realm of like OT stuff, isn't it? And you know,
my wife did a psychology degree, and anything that I ever talk about, you know, I was telling her like, oh, I'm doing loads of reading about this vestibular stuff in the brain, she just always goes, oh, we know basically nothing about the brain. She just, you know, the brain is such a mystery. But reading these things, you know, the coordination of eye and head movement steadies the eye as the head and body move, influencing muscle tone, posture, and perception of spatial awareness, those, I think you could be forgiven for thinking about those and going, right, that's what's happening when children are running up and down the field, you know, at break time. They're thinking about their head, and they're thinking about how do they fix their eyesight on what's going on, and how are their muscles feeling, and all those bits. But it is also happening when they're sitting down and looking at the whiteboard.
Oh, completely. I was just going to say that, exactly that. So that kind of ability to keep your place and look up and then know back where you, you know, go back to where you were, or, you know, basically like executive function as well. So if you can't kind of physically process the world and internally process it, then you're not going to be able to function on many other levels, which are kind of a basic requirement for living as a child in our world. So, yeah,
it's like one of those things that I think a lot of people would take for granted in, oh, I'm going to use an analogy, and this might not be the right analogy, but in the same way that if you suddenly had to think about breathing on manual, you then couldn't focus on somebody talking to you, or you wouldn't necessarily be as able to think about the game that was going on, or focus on the person that's talking to you, if you also had to manually be going, breathe in, breathe out, push your diaphragm down, breathe in, push it that way. And in the same way that lots of adults, whether it's like selective memory or whether it's just that, you know, we maybe don't have the time or facilities or the focus maybe to look at it, but that we go, okay, sitting still and looking forwards is neutral. That's where there's no thought going on. but it isn't. That's where there's immeasurable thought going on, and you know, all this muscle stuff and vestibular stuff. And so if you're holding it together while you sit on the carpet for circle time, you need a release for that, don't you? You need to be able to just go, okay, you've been sat still and trying to balance on a completely still platform. Go and get some, one of the books I was reading was talking about like deep touch. And you know, that pressure thing, and that might be holding a ball on your stomach or leaning really hard against something, pushing really hard, and just going, okay, reconnect now, reconnect with your body and with what's going on around you.
Yeah. So do you want to talk a little bit about the book that you've been reading and sharing bits of with me? So it's got, you said it's kind of got a list of stuff at the front, which is like issues that you might see for some children, so things that they might have difficulty with.
So the book is called Understanding Your Child's Sensory Signals. It's the third edition by Angie Voss. It was just one of the first ones I saw when I looked, I put in kind of vestibular sensory something into Amazon, and I just went, do you know what, I'll just take a book and have a look at it. And it's almost like a physician's desk reference, you know, like people would say, put your symptoms into WebMD and it will tell you that you're going to die in 20 minutes. And so it just has, the contents is like 100 examples of, and it's called, you know, it's called like, child doesn't like being in a shopping trolley, or child is unwilling to change the color of their cutlery, or children being violent to other children, or biting themselves or others. And interesting ones like children who really have to have their hair either being pulled or in a tight ponytail, or children that want to be naked. And you go to the each thing and then you look it up, and it kind of says, this is what's going on with that need, and here are a couple of bullet points that explain what things you could put in place to meet that need, I guess. That's the best way of thinking of it. I do think it's worth the caveat that this book is quite American. So there's some bits in there that I didn't necessarily, you know, they don't work with the way that we would view education or the way that we would view things. But also I think because of the way that the book is laid out, there are things that all children will go through. So without necessarily going into it, my son is just turned 3, and he will have days where he is very particular that he wants the green bowl and he wants the red fork. And you could look at that and go, oh my God, there's a sensory need and he's got this thing, and I'm going to have to buy 1,000 green bowls and a million red forks. Or, you know, some of this stuff will pass, or some of this stuff is, you know, it's not all dysfunction, I guess.
That's needs. It's a need rather than a dysfunction.
It's needs. But the book reads as if like any meltdown or behavior that is, you know, high energy or dysregulated is a sensory need and must be fixed and met in this way, which I kind of agree with, but I kind of think, okay, some things will pass. But with that said, I do think it's a good book that people working in education should have, because it's not very long and it's quite quick to just flick through and go, oh, I've got a child presenting with this. Yeah. What might it be?
Yeah. Yeah. It's also, I was talking with a school nurse recently, and she made a very good example of kind of going back to that thing you were saying about like some types of behavior being presented and it not necessarily being, there is a direct trigger or there is a direct issue there. But she told me a very helpful thing, which was, because I was talking about like sometimes there is a lot of sensory need and you meet that with a lot of like, so in this case a lot of kind of physical rough and tumble play with like slow motion wrestling and things like that, and the need for that might be quite strong for quite a long time, and then you might have a couple of weeks where it doesn't seem to be needed quite so much. And she was saying, well, it's not, think of it like a bucket. So you've got a bucket that's filling with water and it doesn't really matter what the droplets of water represent, but it's something that is challenging in life. And the bucket gets fuller and fuller and fuller and fuller until it overflows. And that overflow is a meltdown, stroke, panic attack, stroke.
Dysregulation.
Yeah, on a quite a big scale. So as a parent or a practitioner, if you're aware that a child may face these issues, rather than thinking about emptying the bucket all the time, or like waiting until the bucket needs to be emptied and it's about to overflow, you need to think of more of your strategies being that you're putting little holes in that bucket so that little bits are coming out all of the time. So if you're thinking about a child or a person's kind of sensory diet and giving them opportunities that allow those little puncture holes all the time to be just draining all the time, so that if it's a, you know, something is a challenge, that there is a way for that water, in inverted commas, to come out, which I thought was quite a healthy way of looking at it, and quite an interesting way of thinking about your own practice. And are you providing enough of a varied sensory diet and enough of different activities that are going to be helpful for young people's kind of proprioceptive system? So I thought that was quite nice.
Support the podcast today by becoming a Patreon member at childrenoftheforest.com. Check out the podcast links for more details.
Yeah, and also kind of thinking, you know, like to just use that analogy again of the frequencies. And I think lots of the, I have seen children get very frustrated when they, so I would say most of the children that come to our groups within a short space of time get quite good at verbalizing what they would like to do, just because of the way our sessions run and because of how we talk to them. They're very comfortable at any point to come up and just go, "Oh, I'm actually bored of it." You know, sometimes to the detriment of our feelings, I'm bored of doing this now, and I really want to do X. And they'll just wait. You know, sometimes it's kind of like, "Oh, okay, well, maybe do this and do." But I guess so. Thinking about that frequency thing is, if there's something like, it's happened for multiple groups, multiple children. You get a child that's fixated on chopping wood, for example. And I know other leaders will say they have children that just want to chop wood all the time. Yeah. But you get that thing where either because it requires more adult supervision, that child ends up monopolizing that activity, or it means that you can't effectively run activities for the rest of the group because you're tied to that one thing. But what it is worth thinking about is if you have a child that wants to do something like chopping wood, tuning in and not just going, "That child wants to chop wood," to go, "That child might want gross motor."
Feedback, that feeling, those sensations. Yeah.
But I would say quite often, and I'm guilty of having done this as a teacher, there'll be something big and sensory and gross motory, and it's a bottleneck for a group of children. And as a holding activity, you suggest something that is completely different in terms of sensory needs. So there's a kid going, "I really need to do something big and feedbacky and using my muscles in a very heavy way." And you go, and one goes, "Okay, well, could you draw a picture of what you'd like to do?" You know, that thing that's like, might be perfect because it might meet that need of, "I'm still involved in wood chopping. I'm still thinking about wood chopping." Mm-hmm. But it might be, you know, again, if you've only got it tuned into sort of theme, then you're going to go, "Theme is chopping wood. Drawing pictures of chopping wood is still chopping wood."
Or I tell you what, why don't you collect some sticks? Because we also need sticks for the fire, and they're collecting like little thin skinny sticks, which is not at all the same need. Yeah, that's exactly right.
But it might work.
Yeah. On the flip side though, one thing that Forest School is really great for, and I think that most of us would do, is that you see some behaviour that is big like that, like chucking stuff, you know, and
pushing stuff over, be that another child
and it might start out with in a way that is too risky or too destructive. It might not look after yourself, other people and nature, so you can't allow it to carry on. However, unlike a very different environment that children might spend more time in, you can go, oh, well, we can't wang the stone at Johnny's head. However, we can wang the stone down the hill, and let's draw a chalk target on the tree and wang the stone there. Or you can kind of keep that same activity as you're describing, you know, that same physical need, and just direct it in a slightly different way so that it's safe enough to continue to do, and also that you've got the time to do it. So in another environment, it's like, okay, yeah, you wanged some beanbags down the field for 20 minutes, but now we have to go inside. Like, you can let that behavior carry on as long as it needs to, and then look at what the next need is, which I think is almost the crux of why I like forest school so much. You know, it just,
do you think you can, so if I was on the I'm going to keep using this frequency thing because it's working for me, if I was to think thematically about, you know, I could plan, the children were really into turtles last week, so we're gonna
mutant ninja turtles.
Yes, Mutant Ninja Turtles. So for my planning for next week, I will plan in some clay turtles, or I will plan in some painting that's of turtle designs or something. And you can plan quite well, I would say, a week ahead and go, I've got some idea that they'll be interested in this, right? If you're thinking on the theme frequency. If you go to the vestibular frequency, and I don't know if you can see, I'm doing this. I am
turning. You're changing the frequency.
I'm changing the frequency with my hand. Do you think you could plan effectively vestibular needs over a week in advance? No. If you were in a school, you could say,
yes.
So there's a level, isn't there, where you could say they're a group that need big games. They're a group that need, that are really into some fine motor stuff. But on a day-to-day basis, I would say that is something that's really hard to turn up and go,
yeah,
you will.
I would say it's more helpful to look at it as a box of tricks. So you might have a kind of, like, whether or not you've written it down and made like a proper profile for each learner, or whether it's just in your brain, especially if you work with somebody else and you've discussed it, and you've got some tricks up your sleeve, just in the same way as any kind of planning with forest school, but thinking more specifically about sensory stuff, that you have a little mental bag of tricks for particular people, particular groups, that you know you can draw on when you need to. So there's some really easy things, like sucking a drink through a straw, like drinking cold water through a straw, or eating a crunchy carrot. Things like that, that are kind of small, you don't need loads of equipment to do, but you know that this child has a water bottle in their bag, and you know, oh, let's all have a drink, you know, and you know that that's going to have a beneficial sensory experience apart from just getting rehydrated. It is also about that. Do you know what I mean? Or you've got, and I think a lot of it we do intuitively. So we know that hammocks are incredibly important for our sessions, and we've found a way to make that work in the current climate where each kid has their own hammock. Because we knew that was one of those things that couldn't be compromised, didn't we? We were writing our risk benefit analysis and thinking about COVID. We were like, right, okay, soft furnishings, how are we going to deal with that? If you can call a hammock a soft furnishing, I'm not sure. But maybe the easiest thing in some ways would be like, oh, we're just not going to use the hammocks for a while. We're just not going to do that. It's like, that is not an option. Like, children need that sensory experience, and they need it to be available at these sort of specific times.
There is a difficulty that comes, though, with, so the box of tricks you just described, the two you described were blowing or sucking with a straw and eating a crunchy carrot, right? Do you think that, from our experience of working in schools and people we know that work in schools, that they are somewhat more able to offer fine motor and breathing exercises because you are quite often are bringing stuff on and off site? If you have to bring in gross motor heavy logs because you've got some kids that need to do big pushing around, now that I think is where school sessions that They, you know, they want you to bring all your stuff in. They want you to take all your stuff out. If they're on a playground, that's one of the things that you suffer with, is there's no big, there's quite often, or even worse, there is big stuff and it's been bolted together by WeBuildPlayGrounds.com with lovely rubber safety screws. And so nothing can be moved that's big. And,
yeah,
and
or it's only in the domain of early years. So a good, just as you were talking, I thought of a really nice thing, which would be, you know, how some schools have like ride on stuff like trikes and things. Your massive friend is sitting on a trike and you are shoving them around, you know, at speed. Like, that is how great for both people. Like, there's some real heavy work in that, and some, you know, and swapping over and getting both those sensations. And you,
I would say that
big
something...
kids playing with little kids stuff, don't you, with that absolute delight and glee. But in so many provisions, that is in a separate area with a fence around it, and you as a big kid don't have access to that. So I often talk about this, but the OPAL Outdoor Playing and Learning charity, they've got an amazing,
we are available
video.
For work if you work for OPAL.
I already asked them, man. I was like, can I work with you, OPAL? But they've got this incredible video of the one day's playtime or lunchtime at a school that they've worked with to develop their play provision, and it's got this amazing moment of like these, they, I think they're probably like year six boys, like shoving each other around the school field in a busted up pushchair and just screaming at the tops of their voices and having an amazing time. And it's one of those things you look at and you're just like, whoa, I have never seen that happen in school playtime. Like, who puts kids, like, beating up kids' pushchairs on the school field and goes, go for your life? But when you watch it, you're like, of course, like, that's exactly what they need.
Well, it was occurring to me that my experience is quite often that years five and six in a primary school, particularly, so my own experience was small Devon primary schools, but or West Country primary schools, but there's this thing, isn't there, of like year five and six, and teachers will quite often say, oh, they're getting a bit big for primary school now, like they're ready for secondary school. But actually, and what they mean is they're shoving each other at the play in the playground, they're squaring up to each other, they're physically, you know, I'll be Jane Goodall again, they are beating their chests, particularly, you know, I'm thinking of boys here, but both genders.
Oh, really. No, both genders. Oh my gosh. I was talking to my kids about this the other day about the game British Bulldog. Did you ever play that? So you've got half the group on one side of the space, the other half the other.
Yeah, but you probably played it on like broken glass or something.
We played it at school on the tarmac playground. You have to like run from one side to the other, and then if you get tagged, then you're in the middle. Yeah. But we did it on piggybacks, and we were in year six, and the whole class was involved. So it wasn't like that normal kind of boys in one area, girls in the other. It was like suddenly the girls and the boys are playing together more, but we're like running at each other, like jousting, like, you know, it would be a girl carrying a boy at full pelt across the playground and trying to smash into each other. So it was a mixture of like incredibly violent, kind of sexual, do you know what I mean, very political, loads of arguments, lots of like grazed knees and bumped heads and fighting and arguing and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I know exactly what you mean. And it was banned, and we were like, it's been banned, what's the point of going to school now that we can't do that? That's all we want to do all the time. Anyhow,
and wouldn't that be an interesting thing if more state education was kind of, when there was behavior like that, said, oh, what's the need here?
Oh, completely.
How can we keep the need but remove the whatever it is that they don't like about it?
Completely. And going back to what you said about being a forest school person and going on site and bringing all of your stuff, a good example of a good thing that you can bring that's easy is rope. So really thick rope, and again, I've talked about this so many times, I'm sorry if I'm boring anyone, but I brought big thick rope into a primary school. I was working with like reception in year one, and I just slung it over a tree, like quite a high tree branch at the edge of the school field, and tied a bucket on one end and just left it and didn't explain it or anything. And then the kids found it and they were like, whoa, this is amazing. And like half the class grabbed one half of the rope and the other class grabbed the other hand, other end, and started almost like a kind of like really big physical tug of war kind of thing, except it wasn't really tug of war because they weren't trying to pull the other team over. They were kind of doing that workplace thing of shouting at each other and going, no, we need more people on the bucket and we need to get the bucket to this bit of the field and keep going. And like, you know, big shouting and big muscles and like having an amazing time. And I was like, I love times like this. I was really interesting to observe it. And a teacher and a TA were standing a bit away from me also, standing observing, and I went up to them and I'm all full of like, isn't this completely fascinating, like Jane Goodall, what are they doing here and what are they getting out of it? And listen, they would, and they weren't saying that at all. They were going, see, this is the trouble with this class, if you give them any free play, this is just what they do, they just become violent and antagonistic and it's just awful, and we said, that's why we can't let them do free play. And I was like, I don't actually hear any like violence or antagonism here. Like, they are shouting and they're using big muscles and they're using big movements, and it is potentially risky, but not really. I mean, the worst that could happen is that someone like falls over because the rope is let go and they fall on the bottom on the grass, you know. Actually, what they're doing is, yeah, shouting, come and help me, or no, you go that way, or we need more people. They're not, you know, calling each other swear words and trying to hurt each other. It's a different, you know, it depends on your lens, doesn't it? And if you're completely conditioned to, as a person working with young people, to be focused on these particular outcomes, then anything that gets in the way of that, like shouting or big physical gestures, because it doesn't arrive at a desired outcome, is seen as negative. And that's very, that doesn't make the practitioner bad, it's just a way of life, isn't it? I'm sure I would have thought exactly the same thing when I was teaching. I'd just be like worried and like, oh no, we can't let them do that, we can't let them do that. But just because you don't know what the outcome is going to be doesn't mean it's wrong.
No,
you can observe it and go, oh, that's really interesting, what are they getting out of that?
There is something as well, isn't there, in the if we sort of broaden this to like vestibular needs and sensory input, in that if you can tune into that frequency, lots of dysregulated behavior looks different. Now, we have had, me personally, I've worked with loads of children in the past for whom the physical sensation of pain is disproportionate in terms of what is, and disproportionate sounds weird because I'm making a judgment on it. And actually, I got into a weird hole a while ago on Facebook where I was asking people, what is the difference between being hurt and being injured? Because I just couldn't work out why they were different or if they were different. And people, lots of people kind of came down on like, hurt is subjective and injured is objective. So, you know, you can decide if that stick hitting your arm hurt. But if you are injured, it is obvious to people around you that you have been injured. But there would be, I would say there's quite often instances of behavioral stuff that looks like aggressive shouting, that looks like resorting in, you know, going to shove someone else over, throwing heavy stuff at them, all those things that are just vestibular dysregulation. They have come from a
definitely.
Place. And one of the things that I find really difficult is on a scientific, maybe it's not scientific, but in a sort of, in a vacuum, if you like, the immediate response or sort of fix would be, right, get some deep pressure in, right? Now that might be push something heavy or do whatever, you know, climb that thing, pick this up. But if they've got to do it on their own, that's, you've then got to distract emotionally to get them into a thing where they can freely choose that thing. The other option is, and you can do this as a parent, is to go, my child is dysregulated, I'm going to bear hug them.
Yeah.
I'm just going to go, right, I'm going to hold on to you for a minute. And not in a like, holding your back, man, let me go, I'm going to get in a fight. But you just go, you need some vestibular feedback right now.
Yeah.
Let me just give you a hug.
Definitely. And that is one of the things, if you're reading about sensory processing issues, one of the kind of things on the checklist is, you know, engages in rough and tumble play with other people and takes it too far, or doesn't respond to the other participants' displeasure, or it seems driven to complete that behavior, those kind of sort of sentences. But you can also kind of go back to the idea of the bucket and say, you really kind of want to be delivering that deep pressure and the bear hugs and other parts of a sensory diet regularly enough that needs are being met before it gets to that point, because as you say, it's quite difficult to then disentangle what's going on in that moment. It's quite hard, and also it's quite difficult. One of the really difficult things there is kind of other observers. If you're a parent and your kid is engaging in this in the playground, or and you're there, or as a practitioner and there's lots of other children around, is that that behavior is seen as naughty. And as you say, like disentangling that as a like a, it's a sensory need thing, they're not doing it because they're feeling aggressive, they're not doing it because they are targeting you, they're not annoyed with you, they don't hate you, they actually probably the opposite, probably they trust you quite well and trust that if they do that to you, you're not going to stop being friends with them forever.
Yeah, it's not a relationship that's in any way at risk. You are unconditional there, and that's the only reason they can do
exactly. So for a child or an onlooker, it's quite hard to distinguish sometimes, I think, between the kind of like but then they did that, so why aren't they being punished and why aren't they being sent home and all this kind of stuff. And that's what makes it doubly difficult for people with these issues. It's like sad.
And you and I talked before about, and it actually relates to what I was saying a bit earlier about this book and about the difference between you know, when is it a need and when is it dysregulation and when is it, you know, because these things present in different ways. You know, my child wanting the green bowl is not the same as the child that like will scream and kick off and do whatever else and smash the kitchen to pieces because the wrong fork was given to them. And what, quite often one of the sort of things to reflect back on is, are they continuing to do it even though they know they're going to get negative results out of it?
Yes.
And that they're going, I need this physical feedback of throwing, of pushing so much that it is worth the negative consequences that I'm going to... Nobody wants the negative consequences, right?
Absolutely.
If you are... If your child, and negative consequences could be something that an adult or a practitioner is putting in place onto that child, but it could also be, and this is more often the case, I think, is that child normally, my experience is, feels horrible after their need has been met. Oh, yeah. They just look and just go, you know, maybe they don't verbalize it, but there is a look and a feeling of, I'm so sorry that.
Yeah.
I did that, that my need presented itself in that way to you.
Yeah.
But if they're continually jeopardizing relationships with their peers for a physical need, you could look at that and go, well, they're not a team player. They don't know how to maintain relationships. We can go, their need for that physical stimulation and that vestibular input is so strong that it is worth sacrificing. You know, we're a social animal.
And that's, and that's where you step in, right? As the adult in that situation and go, well, I have to help you now. I have to do something for you. And the really great thing is that if your idea is of what you're offering, again, not necessarily in the moment, but as part of a overall sensory diet and provision for needs, that if you get it right, then the kind of joy on that child's face, like sometimes... You go, oh, so I reckon the need is this. And so I'm going to provide a completely, you know, neutral time just on a Tuesday morning or whatever. I'm going to do this thing for you. And you might go, nah. But sometimes if you get it right, if it's like, okay, how about we wrap up in a weighted blanket? Yes. How about we do? responds the child. And how about a duvet on top? Yes. Let's make a roly-poly pudding of as many covers as we can. And then how about we like try and lift you up and chuck you on the bed while you're wrapped up like that? And the kind of absolute, like, you know,
you have just described you've basically described my son's bedtime routine.
Yeah. It's amazing, isn't it? And to not think about that necessarily as just a young child thing, like young kids invite that kind of adult play, you know, that sounds dodgy.
There goes the DBS. We thank you very much for joining us as Gemma ruins her childcare. Rhea,
you know what I mean. Sorry.
Join me next week with my new partner.
Okay, so with a toddler, we like naturally play that kind of like, I'm gonna chuck you up in the air, or you know, a baby or whatever, and then they get a bit bigger and you just don't really think of doing that quite so much, but loads of kids still need that kind of play. And what was I going to say? Yeah, just like the disproportionate reaction to pain that you're describing, you might get a disproportionate reaction of joy to something that you think is quite simple. You might get a bit of a, oh my God, that's incredible. And in fact, we get that at Forest School sometimes if you're doing something like walking barefoot or I'm trying to think of a good example, like digging, you know, the kind of, it's almost like the reaction you, the response you get to it sometimes is almost like, all right, chill out. it's just digging.
Find out about CPD courses at childrenoftheforest.com. Check out the podcast links for more details.
Well, the kids that get into, sometimes kids get into a hammock and the hammock is, you know, it's a bit of fabric between two ropes slung up in the trees. Yeah. And some children are just, that is the best bit of their day. Yeah. And not even necessarily like sweat. So, you know, because this is the other thing, isn't it? Is, you know, the diet is a good sort of framework because it's not that you always need to gorge and, you know, stuff yourself with these things. Sometimes being in a static hammock and having that slight wobble as you move is enough, is the perfect level of feedback. So some children will get into a hammock and they will be getting their friend to like swing them to the point where you go, that is going to do 360 in a minute, that is going to go whoop and go completely over. Or how many of our children that we've just owning these children now, one of the ways that we've taught some of our group to get into a hammock, if it's too high for them to climb into, I'm going to try and describe this and people can imagine what's happening. So you stand under the hammock and you put it on your back like a tortoise shell and you put your arms in behind you. So you almost do like a, I don't know what you do it, like an anime character running when they throw their arms behind them, but you grab onto the hammock and then you kick one leg in and then you kick the other leg in and you are suspended upside down. Staring at the floor and like, you know.
And some of them do that after they've got in, don't they?
That's what I mean. It's that sensory feeling of just,
being upside down.
And that ties into this risky thing of, I think Forest School, you know, one of the principles is about needing risk. But I think if you unwrap that a little bit, it's about needing sensory input and vestibular, you know, that's actually what that principle is about. It's not necessarily saying, I mean, it probably is a little bit about, you know, there being some consequence to your actions, but a large part of it is risky behavior has quite often very strong sensory input associated with it, you know?
Oh, definitely. You're seeking out something. You're seeking out a feeling, a response.
And we talk sometimes about, you know, there's lots of stuff in the bits I've been reading about needing to go from big to small. And quite often people, I think, are worried about doing something like whittling because it's fine motor, it is risky, and quite often children aren't in the right emotional space or the right physical space or whatever else. And some of the stuff I've been reading says you need to do something like push the log around the site first.
Yeah, heavy work.
So that you get 5-10 minutes of real heavy work, then do the whittling, because then you've connected to your body in this very obvious way, and then you can connect to your body in this more subtle way.
Yeah, and that also goes for emotionally or socially risky stuff too, right? So we were just reading a bit in that book and it was talking about circle time, as you mentioned before. And so you can, as we've said, I think before on the podcast, about risk also being like, social and emotional. We do go for circle time, like we do that. And we invite children to speak in front of others. And that is really risky for a lot of children. That's terrifying. But we still, and you know, we don't make them do it, but we do always do circle time. And so this book does suggest do some heavy work before doing something that's a bit more socially either demanding or risky, which we're going to try out, aren't we? We're going to do
it. Yeah, I also liked the suggestion that it had of doing, it said, I think the phrase was like an oral fixation. Which probably for a circle time is going to present as a cup of tea. But and then I was like, oh, a cup of tea would be really nice. And then I thought about it and I thought, how many adults would be uncomfortable at a morning meeting if they didn't have a cup
Oh my God.
Partly it's the, I'm holding a cup, it's warm, I've got something to do with my hands, I'm feeling this, I can take a sip every now and again. I could, you know, if you said to an adult, right, sit, put your hands on the desk, we're now going to do the morning meeting.
Yeah, God.
We would all find it really hard. Something about a cup and a mug is...
Yeah, but maybe it's also that it's the sensory stuff of drinking the liquid, and it's... Because you often think about it as kind of the communal activity and the ritual of it all, and we're all doing it together, and the caffeine. But I think you might be right there. Also, like, when you've been reading, have you noticed that you have any of your own little self-regulation sensory things when you're reading?
I do an hour and a half of picking up the heaviest things I possibly can morning. Yeah. That is, if that isn't vestibular input, I don't know what it, I knacker myself.
Yeah.
First thing in the morning.
So my hair twirling, which I basically do, I don't know how often I do it at forest school, actually. Do I do it a lot during the day?
No, but if you are twiddling your hair, it normally, to me, signals that you're quite relaxed about what's happening. You're quite... you're not running around in the middle of a hunters and rabbits game twiddling your hair.
Thinking, or if I'm a bit tired, but it's definitely like a coping mechanism, definitely. And you never really think about it like that. When I used to work in a school, and we'd sit in the staff room with about 50 teachers for like morning meeting with the head. I didn't realise I always did it. And then the head of PE, who was this lovely bloke called Gino, who was like my kind of dad at work, he would just like meet my eye and then mime me twirling and then smile. And then I'd like, you're tired. And I was like, oh yeah. Like I do it a lot, but if I couldn't do it, my life would be rubbish. It's like a thing that I need to do. And fiddling, a lot of fiddling all the time.
I think I had it when I had, because I had dreadlocks for about 8 years and they were massive and heavy. And I definitely used to like fiddle with that and flick my hair about. And do you know what I had? I got my tongue pierced when I was 15. And I was one of those people that used to clack it against my teeth.
Oh, lovely. That's not annoying for anybody else.
Oh, no. Utterly horrible, horrible, horrible.
Yeah, but I don't think I need to do all my little fiddly, weirdy things that I do.
Okay, well, that's
Adam and Joe do self fiddle phone-in vaccination. I'm sure they do, self fiddles. I'm sure they do. What do you do?
Okay, what I want in the comments on Facebook or...
what do you do?
What is your self fiddle? And don't explain it anymore. Just put like, my self fiddle is... And then
I do this thing with my thumbnail, my nail of my ring finger, where I put it underneath my thumbnail. I'm doing it right now. If my nails get too long, then I do it loads. I have to keep my nail really short. There's millions of them. But I don't think I need to do them when I'm in the woods, which is interesting, right?
You know, my little boy now, thanks to you, I'm pretty convinced that if the neighbours didn't already think we were weird for many other reasons, there's pigeons nesting in the hedge at the back of our garden, and my little boy will stand out in the garden and just at the top of his lungs shout, "My doggy, Betty!" Which, if you don't know that that's how we remember pigeon noises, just sounds like my three-year-old has lost the plot.
Yes, and... Do you know, they on Six Music at the moment, they've been doing a thing called House Music, where you send in a recording of your fridge and the weird noise it makes and what it reminds you of, like a song or whatever. But today, somebody sent in a recording. Lauren Laverne I don't think she knew that it was a blackbird, but it was a blackbird. She's like, someone sent in this recording of a bird in their garden, and it sounds just like, I'm a Barbie girl in a Barbie world. I was like, well, yeah, duh, everyone knows that.
Yeah, it's funny, those things, isn't it?
Yeah.
That just, yeah, obviously, blackbirds do I'm a Barbie girl.
Of course. But then whenever we share that with a group, everyone's too young to know that song, so it doesn't really work.
I mean, everyone's too young. Everyone's exactly the same age as me.
Did you know that song?
Yes. Okay. For novelty purposes.
Okay.
But, yeah. Okay.
Okay. Cool. Bye. Right.
Bye.
Bye.
If you like this podcast and want to support more episodes, you can donate through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/children of the forest to show your support for the Forest School podcast.